as David Suzuki, the famous TV host, author, and environmental activist, turns 70 and releases his biography entitled David Suzuki. He's interviewed by Ryan Young of community radio CKUT in Montreal in May of 2006.
This is Ryan Young, and I'm here with Dr. David Suzuki. And as David mentioned in a talk recently, I'd like to acknowledge that this is Mohawk territory that we're on and thank the Native people for taking care of this natural area for so long, for thousands of years.
Well done.
Thank you. So, David, your new book, your new autobiography, self-titled, you talk a lot about your father. And I'm a naturalist myself, and you say that he was a naturalist. So maybe you could maybe describe the relationship your father had with the natural world.
Well, you know, in many ways, my father was a disappointment to his parents, my grandparents, because like typically new immigrant arrivals, their first concern is to make money. And as the eldest son in the family, he was told by his parents, you've got to go out, work hard and make money, because money to them meant security. And I was always grateful that my dad never followed their instructions. And I used to say, Dad, you're my mutant. You know, you somehow mutated away from those values, because he always taught us you have to work hard in order to make money because you need the necessities in life, but you don't run after money as an end in itself. And I can remember as a boy, we used to visit his parents every week. And they used to bawl him out all the time. You know, why did you take David camping on the weekend when you should have been working and making money? You know, you're just taking too much time off. And for me, my dad was my big hero. And I resented it very much what my grandparents were telling him. And he taught us, you know, that you should pity people that brag about how much money they're making or their fancy clothes or their big cars. Because he said they've got off on the wrong tangent. That's not what life is all about. So I've always been grateful to him for that. But the big thing that he loved was the out-of-doors. And he took me camping. My earliest memories are of camping when I was 4 years old. And he took me fishing. His great love was fishing. And that stayed with me all my life. But it was through fishing and camping that I came to understand our need for nature. We all have that built into us. Most of us now live in cities. And what I see is, when kids come in, often they might have a little bottle with, a worm or a spider or a caterpillar. And I see the parents going, take that out of here, like teaching them to be afraid or to feel disgust towards nature. I think my dad was the great influence in my life, but my mother did something so wonderful for me. When I was in London, Ontario, we moved there in 1949. I was a teenager by then, and I had girls on the brain. Like, that's all I thought about was girls. And fortunately, there was a very big swamp near our house. And I'd ride my bike over to the swamp. And the minute I could walk into the swamp, I'd forget all about girls, because the swamp is a magical place. And I had a net and a bottle, and I'd dip all kinds of things in. And I'd come home covered in mud and soaking wet. My mother never, ever said, stay out of the house. Don't come in with your wet clothes. She would let me come in, just slop all over the floor. And every time I held out my jar with, she'd look at it and go, oh, you've got salamander eggs. I've never seen them before. Isn't that wonderful? And she acted as if what I was doing was the most wonderful thing. And that support of my love of nature was a great gift from my mother as well.
Wow. Now, I guess, as a naturalist growing up, you learned all kinds of things. The whole world was opened up to you. Do you still have time to learn other new things about the natural world today?
Oh, I learn all kinds of things. And the wonderful part of it today is that I'm learning it through my children. My two youngest children, one's an ethnobotanist. So she's studying the way that First Nations people on the West Coast used plants. She's just opened up a whole area to me now. I didn't realize that Native people on the West Coast actually farmed clams. They had what they call clam gardens, and they would build little areas right at low tide where the sand and shells and things could wash in and gradually fill up an area, and the clams would grow in there. Through my daughter, she's now studying the role that eelgrass plays. Eelgrass is one of those keystone species, and it's in the intertidal areas. lots of fish lay their eggs in eelgrass. Squid come in and lay their eggs, and it's a very important, critical species. And it turns out that the First Nations ate eelgrass, and they actually cultivated eelgrass from the way that they harvested it. So there's a whole other area, the interaction of traditional peoples and the environment. You know, we Europeans came to British Columbia, and they thought these savages, you know, they don't know anything. But the fact is, they were actually gardening animals, growing animals and plants. My youngest daughter just graduated, in fact, last week from Berkeley in marine biology. And through her eyes, again, you know, she's actually studying fish scientifically, and I'm learning a whole new other area. So fortunately, my world is still wide open to discovery.
That's great. Another naturalist, John Livingston, that was behind a lot of, the team behind you at the Nature of Things for some years, he died early this year. Could you describe maybe to me what kind of effect he had on your own thinking?
Well, Jake was a very tough guy. You know, he was he didn't suffer fools easily, and a lot of people had a difficult time getting along with him. And he and I, in fact, we didn't always see eye to eye. For example, I was very involved with the anti-nuclear movement, and he used to say to me, "What are you bothering that for?" And I said, "Well, you know, I think this represents a tremendous threat, the buildup of the arms race. I mean, surely you're interested in that." And he said, "If we're so stupid that we're going to blow ourselves up, the sooner the better." And he really was almost a misanthrope in that, you know, he felt that humans had got off on this very destructive path and destroyed birds. He was an avid birder, and he just hated the way that humans were destroying the natural world. But what Jake did for me that was so important, I had come in thinking that humans were at the center of the action, and that really our dealing with the natural world was a statement about what we valued, that another species was important to me because humans were so aware and intelligent that we were the ones that could appreciate what a beautiful thing that was and leave it alone. And so I thought that we had to focus on humans. We're at the center of the action. What Jake had was a very different approach, and that is humans are just one species out of maybe 30 million. And that it's the whole focus on human beings as a center of the action that had got us into the problem in the first place. So where I was taking an anthropotropic position that humans were at the center, he took a biocentric position that humans were just a part of a much greater whole. And that was a very, very important thing for me to shift that vision.
Mm. Wow. Now, you did a lot of television work, obviously, with The Nature of Things. You're also the first voice of Quirks and Corks, the CBC radio program about science. And you say in your book that radio was really your favorite medium. And why is that?
Well, it's a wonderful medium because, first of all, you create all of the images in the listener's head. And basically, the listener does all the work for you, you know, and with just through sound and words. You know, I can talk about things that couldn't. Spike Jonze did a wonderful thing on this. You could show a clip about this, you know, and through sound, he created this vision where you had a whole army of people and planes flying through the air and dropping stuff in a giant mound of whipped cream. And, you know, like all of that, you just have to say it and someone creates it in their own head. And that's the beauty of radio, is that everybody listens and they do the work for you. It's just a matter of getting it out. And the other thing I love is that, because radio can be easily edited, you know, you can go through miles and miles of tape and then just cut out what you need. And it's a very warm, you and I could sit there and as we get to know each other, you know, you forget all about the microphones and we're just talking. And there's just a warmth and a closeness that you can't get on television. Television, every minute is so important that it's all got to be designed and set up. Every shot has got to be lit the right way. So it becomes a complete artificial situation. Then you put the person in. Well, you can't let them just rattle off and tell jokes and all that sort of stuff. They got to deliver the line that you want. And so it's a completely contrived kind of medium, whereas radio is much more warm and natural.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you've been involved in the Canadian university environment for some time as a professor and, you know, dating back, I guess, to the early 60s. What kind of changes have you seen in the Canadian universities?
You know, I haven't been teaching now for, well, over 20 years, but certainly I feel looking at high school students, they're every bit as idealistic and excitable as students were when I was in high school. What I think the terrible aspect of what's happened to the universities is that the universities have made a terrible bargain for money. To me, a university is a very, very special place in our society. It's a place where you have scholars and dreamers and students all coming together to explore ideas at the very cutting edge of human thought. It's a very exciting place. The problem is when you've got scholars and dreamers and artists dreaming, often the ideas they're playing with are threatening to society. I mean, where was Das Kapital born? But in a university. And it's not an accident that when you look at around the world, many revolutions have started in the university. You know, I was just in Cuba recently, and Castro went up at the University of Havana, and that's where he started the revolution. And because of that, there's a lot of pressure always from society to shut those damn professors up. You know, they shouldn't be teaching our kids these things. And what we've done in our wisdom is given professors tenure. And tenure is not a job guarantee. It is meant as a protection so that scholars can explore ideas and not worry that someone's going to come in and fire them. And to me, tenure was a great liberating thing. When I got tenure, I now knew I had qualified as a scholar to be a part of the university community, and I felt I now had the responsibility to speak out about topics that I knew something about, and I could do that without fear of getting fired. A lot of people now regard tenure as just job security. Once they got tenure, they don't have to worry about anything else. But the terrible thing that's happened is that universities, in order to get more funding, have welcomed the private sector into the university. Indeed, you know, you look at the University of Wisconsin, they were co-partners in a discovery of a chemical called warfarin, which kills rats. And I think warfarin stands for Wisconsin Agricultural Research Fund or something. And because of they were involved with that professor, they've got millions and millions of dollars from that one discovery. So universities welcomed, when biotechnology happened, they welcomed biotechnology into their halls. But the result of that was you begin to set up private companies. Suddenly, the openness and collegiality of the community disappeared. Now students who were working in those labs couldn't speak out because of they wanted to patent those ideas. Suddenly, professors who are working in biotechnology or genetic engineering don't want to talk anything critical or about the area. And so it's changed. The university is no longer that area of radical thought and free exchange. You know, we did a show after the Arab oil embargo in 1974. We decided to do a show on Alberta tar sands because there was only one plant. Syncrude was present then. It was putting out 50 tons of sulfur dioxide a day. That's a lot of acid rain. The premier of Alberta, Peter Lougheed, was talking about building 10 more plants bigger than Syncrude. That's a lot of acid rain. So we went to the University of Alberta in Edmonton. Lots of ecologists. None of them would talk to us on camera. Went to the University of Calgary. Lots of ecologists. None of them would talk to us on camera. Why? They were all getting grants from the oil industry. So then you say, wait a minute, what's going on? This is an area of great concern to the public. You're an ecologist. You could tell us what the implications are. You're not going to tell us? What the hell are you doing in the university then? You don't deserve tenure. I think it's a very, very destructive thing for the universities to get into bed with the private sector because it's not the same thing as it used to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I know in your book you talk about a change in thinking from back in, and I remember in the late 80s, this is what we always heard of think globally, act locally.
Yeah.
And you changed your thinking to think locally and act locally.
So I used to run around like everybody else saying think globally, act locally. But over time, I began to realize when ordinary people think globally and think about things like global warming or species extinction, they go, oh my God. It's so huge. And who the hell am I? I'm just one person out of 6 billion. I'm nothing. I'm insignificant. So rather than empowering people, that slogan disempowered them by imbuing a sense of helplessness. And that's why I really do think that it's at the local level that you can get involved and actually see the chance of doing something. So I say think locally and act locally, and that's the only way that we will have an effect globally, when a lot of people are working at the local level. Now, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be have people thinking about the big picture. We've always got to be thinking about the big picture. But for most people, I think it's far more profitable to get involved in stopping spraying in the schoolyard, or, you know, Montreal, I know now, doesn't have has no pesticides. And I know one of the people that was critical in that was a woman named Esther Goldenberg. And boy, you know, she just worked tirelessly over years and years. And by God, she got it done. And I think that's where people can feel, wow, I can actually achieve something.
Yeah, absolutely. You have a summer place on one of the islands off of Vancouver Island. I believe it's called Tangwyn.
Yeah, we call it Tangwyn.
You call it Tangwyn.
Yeah, place of blessed peace.
Okay. And just maybe put into perspective for me, I know you really like fishing. Put into perspective how the ocean ecosystems have changed over the years.
Well, this is a terrible aspect. You know, we live in Vancouver, and when we go to our cottage on Quadra Island, we have to take two ferries. We go to Vancouver Island, drive 2 hours, and then take another ferry over to our island. And as we get closer to our island, the last ferry, we can see these boils of herring and huge bundles and eagles diving down to catch them and salmon leaping all over. And we go, oh, it's so great to be back in nature, you know, the way it always was. Then I talk to my neighbor, Dan LeClaire, who's lived on Quadra for over 60 years. And when he describes what it was like when he moved there, you just want to weep because, you know, he said, when I was a kid, you used to be able to go out in a little punt, a little rowboat, and with a rake, a garden rake, you'd go to the kelp beds and rake herring into your punt, and you could fill it in 15 minutes. They were that abundant. He said, we could go out any time and catch a red snapper. Ling cod and rock cod were just, you could, any time you could pull one up for a meal. Well, the fact is the herring near our place were wiped out in one commercial fishery for 1 year. They were wiped out. Now it's almost 20 years later. This year was the first time we began to see herring in abundance in our little bay. He said that the salmon used to be so numerous that you could hear them coming miles away. They were jumping as they were approaching the island. You could hear them coming. You knew when they were coming. We've never heard any of that. There are no red snapper left at all. Ling cod now. It took 8 years before we were fishing for red rock cod, and my wife caught a large ling cod. And I was all excited. She pulled up this big fish. She just took it off the hook and let it go. I said, what are you doing? She said, David, we've been here for 8 years. This is the first big ling cod we've caught. There's no way you can kill in that. And she was right. Now we've gone from being able to catch rock cod any time to where the government is saying you can only catch one rock cod a day. Well, we shouldn't be catching any rock cod. There just aren't enough because the fishing fleet's been taking them in large numbers and sending them to Asia. So if I look at what the oceans were when Dan LeClaire was there, I inherited the property. I got the property. It was already empty. But even in that time, the fish that we were relying on, the ling cod and rock cod, they've gone. And, you know, they came and pumped gooey ducks, a large clam, which lives up to 120 years. They will bring $100, $200 in the Orient. They're pumping them out of the water as if they're little nuggets of gold. And they have no idea how these animals reproduce. And, you know, we're just destroying that resource. Abalone were wiped out by scuba divers about 20 years ago. They've never come back. So what I'm presiding over is the liquidation of these great resources that should have been there forever. And we saw it on the East Coast, of course, in 1992, a fishery that had been used by humans for over 500 years, the northern cod off Newfoundland. In 1992, the government finally said, look, there aren't enough moratorium. Everybody thought that was going to be a 2-year moratorium. And then, boom, we'd go back to fishing. It's 14 years later, and all indications are there are fewer northern cod today than there were in 1992. So there's a case where this immense biomass, I mean, you read the reports of John Cabot, when he came, his ship literally could not enter into bays because the fish were so abundant, the ship couldn't go in. They could drop wicker baskets off the boat and just fill them up and bring load after load. If you look at the pictures, even in the 1900s, of people with cod that would go from the ground up, 6 feet tall, those are all gone. It's one of the great tragedies. When I went to high school in the 1950s, my teacher said, the oceans are filled with limitless replenishable fish. Well, in 1950, they probably were, but they're not now. Over 90% of the major fishes in the ocean now are gone, and they're not coming back.
And why do you think, government departments like the Department of Fisheries and Oceans have failed to manage that resource?
I think the problem is that you've got a system built on a pyramid. The Minister of Department of Fisheries and Oceans is the top dog. And then under him are the bureaucrats, and then under them are the scientists. And the problem is the politician gets to dictate what all the statements and policies are. So he's driven, or she is driven, by a political agenda. And the science then has to be filtered through all of these political filters. And so a scientist cannot just speak out and say, look, we got to stop fishing for these fish immediately, or else they're toast. A minister will not allow that to be said. And it's the same with, land. We've got government scientists in BC that are saying there are far fewer grizzlies than we ever thought. We shouldn't be hunting them. That's never allowed to be said. The scientists who have said that have been fired. So we've got a system that is not built on assessing scientific data. It's all filtered and manipulated through a political agenda. And that's a very destructive thing, because politicians, they're not thinking long term. They're thinking, what's the next election? Okay, if I stop fishing in the next 2 years, then when I go to the election 3 years from now, I'm going to get my ass kicked. I can't afford to do that. So they do everything they can to delay making those decisions. And meanwhile, everything gets fished down.
And what's your impression of the present government, the Harper government, in terms of...
Well, I was willing to give him time. He's a minority government. I thought for sure that the minority position would mean it would be a government that was much more cautious in the way it would proceed. He understands very clearly the Liberals are in total disarray. There's no way they're going to do anything to bring the government down until they've had their leadership convention. So he's really got a free at least a year and a half where he doesn't have to worry. And he's brought in a very radical agenda. That's fine. That's his prerogative. But what bothers me is the really hostile attitude towards Kyoto, for example. He's gutted everything, including some programs that really were effective, I felt. But what I think has not been said is that Canada officially ratified Kyoto. We made a commitment when Chrétien signed the Kyoto Protocol. When Putin from Russia ratified, it became international law. Over 60% of the countries had now ratified, and now it is an international law. Australia and the United States never signed. They said that they were going to be international renegades. They did not believe in this. Canada has never been in that kind of a position, as far as I'm concerned. Canadians, you ask Canadians what they think is their international reputation and position. We take pride in the fact that we are international citizens. We take pride in the fact that we didn't just follow the Americans and go into Iraq. We said, we'll do what the United Nations decides. Canada has always been proud of its international role. And now here we're saying we're going to just toss this out and we're going to turn our backs on this. Well, I don't think that's how you proceed in a world of international law. And I don't understand why the press hasn't really gone after Mr. Harper on this. Is this what we're heading for? A Canada that's under the armpit of the United States and to hell with international rule? I don't think Canadians will stand for it.
Yeah. On a more positive note, what gives you hope after 70 years?
Well, I have grandchildren. I have no alternative. I have to have hope. If I simply allowed myself to look at where we are today and where we're going, I would feel very, very frustrated and frightened. But I have grandchildren, and I have no alternative but to say we've got to work as hard as we can and hope things will turn around. And my great inspiration is Nelson Mandela. Nelson Mandela was jailed during the prime of his life. He knew that the government would have allowed him out of jail if all he had to do was quit the ANC and renounce violence, and they would have let him out. And after 10 years, after 15 years, after 20 years, there must have been times when he said, Nelson, what a fool you are. Your life is going right down the drain. You could get out now. You could go to bed with your wife. You could have a whole other life. But he didn't. And he never had, I'm sure he never dreamt that within his lifetime, apartheid would be dead and that he would become president of South Africa. But he believed in what he was in prison for, and he hung in there. And I don't think anyone, if he, after 27 years, could achieve that, nobody's got the right to say it's too late. We've just got to hang in there the way Nelson Mandela did. What an inspiration.
Mm. Thank you. Maybe one last question. You know, a lot of us, like myself, we're big fans of The Nature of Things, still are. And we, you know, I have to say myself, they did glisten like jewels in the mud for me. And I did kind of like wait to watch them and then discuss them after. But we've seen a real kind of reduction in the budget that Nature of Things gets every year. Why is that? Or what is the future for The Nature of
Things? Well, I think to a lot of people in CBC, they're always concerned about what's the next show that's going to make big ratings. So although they talk about, you know, the mandate of the CBC and it's not about ratings, it's about getting, you know, good programming on ballet and all that, that's bullshit. The fact is they're very, very concerned about what ratings are, and they're always looking for the big hit. And when you get a show like The Nature of Things, it's been on air since 1960, the longest running series in Canada. You know, to a lot of these young bucks that are trying to make it big and make a splash, you go, oh, Christ, is that old show still on? You know, like, to me, this is a real, talk about Survivor. We're the survivors. This is reality TV, if you've ever seen it.
Yeah.
This is, you know, survival of the fittest. We should be considered the creme de la creme.
Absolutely.
But we get taken for granted. Whenever the CRTC is looking at the CBC's mandate, we get trotted out. This is the kind of programming CBC. And then we get shoved back in the closet and forgotten again. So our actual budget per show has just been scandalously neglected. We've now got a man in charge of documentaries, Mark Starowitz, who was, you know, he brought Barbara Frum into prominence, and he's the one that did the very successful series on Canada, the history of Canada. He's now in charge of documentaries, and The Nature of Things is put under his reign. And he has said, you guys are just outrageously under-budgeted, and I want to try to see what I can do to improve that budget. So I think there's this is a very exciting moment for us. The problem, of course, is that we're faced with a constantly growing competition with cable and satellite receivers. People can have anywhere from 70 to 300 channels to select from. So the audience is being fragmented over and over again. When I first began working with The Nature of Things, and this is in the early 1970s, if we got less than 1.5 million viewers, we started really jumping around. We're very, very worried because we like to have it up around 1.8, 1.9 million. We haven't had 1 million people in over 10 years. Mm. Over time, as more and more channels came in, our audience, although we have a respectable audience by CBC standards, we have just dropped steadily over time. And so what do you do then when you've got someone sitting on a couch with a remote control and they're just going ka-chung, ka-chung, ka-chung? When they click onto you, you have to grab their attention. So how do you do that? You shout. You're more sensational. You're more sexy. You're more violent. The last gangbuster rating we had was when we did a show called Fallacies, spelled P-H-A-L-L. It was on the penis. And I knew damn well we'd get a blockbuster rating, and we did. It's not an accident, I think, that we've done a show on psychopaths, that we've done a show on female castration. I mean, we're in the same business of trying to get that audience, and we use what seem to be sensational themes. But of course, the price you pay for that is greater superficiality, and I think we don't really dig at issues as seriously as we should be.
So what does the future hold for David Suzuki?
Well, I, you know, as long as I'm healthy, I would like to see the nature of things continue. I think it's a very important avenue of information for Canadians. I can't do it forever, but CBC's been very generous in making the job much easier for me in that I don't have to go to travel around to do all my interviews and stand-ups. And I can do a lot of the material right in the studio with a green backdrop. So it's not an onerous load for me. And, I'm 70 now, and every year is a gift from now on. But as long as I'm healthy, I'd like to stay with the show and work towards a successor taking the nature of things over. I've got a few ideas, but I won't share them with you. But for me, I'd like to really slow down. I'm committed to try to get my foundation on a footing so that when I kick the bucket, they'll still have a base of funding. So we're trying to raise money for an endowment and that the foundation can depend on. And I'd like to do that over the next couple of years. And then I'd really like to take a lot of time to do things I haven't done for 40 years. You know, I want to learn Spanish. I would like to study geology. I'd like to do some wood carving because so many of my First Nation friends are wonderful carvers. And I'd like to read and paint.
That's great.
Keep me busy.
Well, thanks for being with us today, David.
Thanks for having me.
Take care.
Dr. David Suzuki in his 70th year, interviewed by CKUT Montreal.